Now, one of the things you've alluded to several times.
Well, let me add a footnote to what we were talking about on the other side about this article in the Princeton Alumni Weekly. I wouldn't be surprised if Bob Huntley, his view on coeducation was vastly different from mine, which simply is, I wish. Speaking from my own self, I think I did well at Washington Lee, partly because there was not the distraction of young women around. I find the company of young women very pleasant, and not that I studied so hard while I was here or anything like that, but I think I could have been very easily distracted as a student. So I think that there is a place for single-sex education. I regret the fact that the imbalance that was spoken to in this Princeton article became so severe. The Princeton article mentioned the fact that you had to have a certain number of men's colleges to make this work. And when it got down to a precious few, that they became unusual. In other words, they were out of the mainstream of education, appeared to be out of the mainstream of education. Bob Huntley said essentially the same thing long before we ever saw the Princeton article. He said that Washington Lee should never permit itself to be perceived as quaint. And so when you get down to just a few colleges are doing something as narrow as, say, we're going to only teach men, well, that can be perceived as being quaint by others. And he said, we shouldn't embrace quaintness. later on, when President Wilson was under severe criticism among many alumni for having brought up the coeducation issue and appearing to advance it in a way that made everyone think that he thought it was the best idea for Washington Lee, which I think he did. John Wilson was under severe criticism, and I saw some of the mail that would come to him, and he would share it with me. I was his assistant at the time. And I remember him reading excerpts to me from letters, and he would say, I can't survive this. And I would try to reassure him that indeed I thought he could survive it. And at that time, Bob Huntley was a member of the law school faculty and occupied an office over in Lewis Hall. And I dropped in to see him one day, and I either volunteered the information knowing that he was interested in it, or he may have asked me. Bob was always very circumspect about inquiring about how John Wilson was conducting his presidency. The last thing he wanted to do was to be intrusive or be perceived as overly interested. But we got to talking, and Bob gave me some advice that I should implement as the president's assistant, and one was, don't let the president or the trustees get concerned about the monetary costs of converting the campus in ways to accept women. And I can almost remember his word, you and I both know that these buildings will not require much modification. And he said also, he said, John Wilson must not lose this fight. He says if he does, he's done as president. I'm not sure he used exactly those words, but that was the sentiment, that John must not be permitted to fail in this initiative, because he felt that should the trustees vote him down, that John, I think Bob Huntley had a very high regard for John Wilson, and he did not want to see his presidency end on that note, but I think he felt that John would have had a tough time to be then a forward-moving, assertive president after that. Fortunately, none of that happened. That the trustees did support the coeducation initiative, and they did so under rather rigorous rules. I've often said that if Jack Warner wanted to lead the fight against coeducation, he should not have resigned from the board. He should have stayed on, and with a little bit of persuasive power, he might have won at least one other trustee, and that's all it would have taken. His vote and somebody else's, because the trustees decided that this issue was too important to be settled by a simple majority, as most issues are before the board. And so they said it had to be a two-thirds vote. And again, here I'd want to check my records on this, but it was by their rules, it was a narrow vote. I mean, it was substantially wide. I'll just say 15 to 11 or something like that, but it would only have taken two votes to swing it around, so it didn't work. Mm-hmm. So, no, it was 15 to 7 or something. It was by a two-third majority, but not much of a cushion mm-hmm. for that majority. So, so we made the transition. I was looking over the ways in which I tried as the editor of the alumni magazine. That was my role. In addition to being an assistant to the president, I also was the person in charge of our public relations office and publications office.
At what time? What time period are we talking about?
No, this is in the early 80s.
Okay. You've had so many hats, Frank. Well, you have to keep them straight.
This was a strange situation. When I became Bob Huntley's assistant, even though it defied all the other orderly tables of organizations that most colleges have, ours, for good reason, at least we thought it was good reason at the time, members of our staff who had been hired by me and who worked for me up to the time I became Bob Huntley's assistant, they continued to report to me, and they did not want to report to somebody else. And so Bob Huntley, in his wisdom, said they didn't have to. We could work this out. We didn't have to follow any rigid table of organization, and it worked quite effectively. Bob Huntley also had the good sense to sit down with me and to make certain that I had the good sense to be aware of the fact that the new president coming in might not want me as his assistant. And so therefore, so that my long service to Washington Lee could continue, that maybe we ought to figure out something else for me to do. And I thought about it, and I said, well, what I can do, I could go back to being in charge exclusively over the PR, the publicity office, and the publications office. And at that time, too, I was also responsible for the print shop, which was sort of a back shop wing of the publications operation. It no longer was part of the journalism department in ways that it used to be, in ways that it came into being. So I proposed that I have the title of university editor, and that this would give me some influence over the alumni magazine and other publications, the catalog, and would continue to enable these individuals who worked for me before to continue in a happy relationship, one that they were comfortable with. And I'll speak here not for the record, but I was dealing with three very unusual, very talented persons. I was dealing with Bob Keefe, who had his own perspective on things. I was dealing with Ron Weatherman, who also had some difficulties that he made no secret of. He had suffered greatly from depression and was either riding a high or riding a very deep low. He was a roller coaster man from day one. And then we had the irrepressible Sally Mann as our photographer, who brought with her certain sensitivities that had to be dealt with.
Oh, not Sally.
But these were three immensely talented people. When I go back and look at the alumni magazines and that we turned out with those contributions from those three persons, well, I always feel very proud that I was involved with bringing them to bear on Washington Lee's publications. Well, anyhow, I was a university editor at that time. And one of the things that I set out to do very purposefully was to let the magazine be a forum. And at that time, we introduced the letters to the editor column to be a forum in which alumni, in addition to writing specifically to the president, they could express their views where they'd be seen by other alumni. And I wanted to give Jack Warner a forum in which to express his views. And I wanted an opportunity for the president and others here in support of, who want to support coeducation, or at least to identify the issues. If they didn't come out in support of it, we wanted at least to be able to identify the issues as to why it was timely to think about this. We wanted to have a forum for that. I alluded earlier to this article I did on the history of coeducation. We kept the alumni updated. At that time, the alumni magazine came out six times a year, every 2 months. And this was a frequency that helped us keep the issue before them. I invited Marshall Knuckles, former rector of the board, to permit me to write something for him that he'd be willing to have printed over his name, which addressed the responsibilities the trustees have, and so what we did, we literally printed the names of all the trustees who were going to have to bear this burden of making this decision, and we did that so that alumni out there wanted to get in touch with them, they could. They knew who was on the board. They wouldn't have to wonder who was on the board of trustees, and we had in this little statement by Marshall Knuckles, former rector, well, he pointed out how the trustees should perceive themselves as individuals holding in trust the future of this institution. And so we did that, and we reported on the results of our survey of alumni. Tried to present that, although if there was a failing in these efforts, we somehow didn't stress enough that this survey of alumni attitude wasn't a referendum. People say, "Well, we voted it down, didn't we?" Well, no, you didn't vote it down. We didn't. It wasn't a yay nay, voted up or voted down thing. We were simply trying to find out what you thought about it, and the purpose of the survey was to establish the climate in which the trustees would make the decision. We wanted the trustees to be aware of the climate in which they were making the decision. And so that survey, I think, helped them in that regard, because the survey, first of all, it went out to all alumni for whom we had good addresses, and out of some 16,000, I'm speaking round numbers here, we got back somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 returns. And the questions were very carefully worded, trying to avoid questionnaire bias. We engaged a firm experienced in this, and as I recall, they did not, in their first efforts, they did not do as well as we wanted to do in that. We could read into it bias. And I remember working very hard trying to rephrase some of their questions, and I think we were successful in doing that. And the reason I think we were successful was that when I would try to respond sometimes or to help President Wilson respond to letters that would come in, about as many people claimed we were biased in favor of coeducation as were claimed we were biased against the other side. So we offended people on both sides of the issue. So therefore, one interpretation you could put on that is that it was an unbiased questionnaire. It spoke to a lot of things. But we asked them, if you had your druthers, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you had your druthers, should Washington Lee remain all male or become coeducational? And they would, and the majority, it was not an overwhelming majority, but a majority of those responding said they'd like for it to remain all male. And then we asked them, would you want this condition to prevail if it meant the university's academic quality would be lessened? And then it flipped around. No. They would only want to remain all male if we could continue to be the best institution of which we were capable of being, and that if we were going to be less than that, then they would, their attitude toward coeducation as a remedy was changed. And there were other questions that began to draw the fine distinctions of conditions. And then we sought other, that we've never used, in my opinion, that study in ways that we could benefit from it. There was an awful lot of good information in there about how they perceive the institution and their general attitudes from the alumni perspective. As you know, our alumni are spread all across the United States, and we take great pride in attracting students from all over the United States, and these same students as alumni tend to disperse themselves all over the country. And so our alumni magazine very often is the most convenient and perhaps the best medium for communications we have with the rank and file alumni. Not all of our alumni are associated with chapters. They may live within a circumferential circle that would draw them into a chapter. But if you live 60 miles away from a chapter, like, well, there is a chapter in Lexington, but for instance, if there were none here and Roanoke were the closest chapter, it would take a little effort on my part mm-hmm. to get down for events that they would plan.
Who has the study? Where, if I want to go and look at it?
It's right in this box.
Right in this box, of course. Frank has everything. Well, John Wilson alluded to that, so that was something, that's definitely something I'm very interested in looking at.
Want me to say anything about how that special meeting to decide the issue came about? It was held in
sure.
in mid-July, and actually the decision was made on Bastille Day. it was a very interesting meeting.
Now the board normally meets in June.
Board met in May, I
in
think,
May.
Late May. Normally meets three times a year, usually in October, again in sometimes in late January, February, sometimes as late as early March, and then again in late May. But this was a special meeting. They felt that they did not want to have to deal with the issue of coeducation in a climate of other distractions, such as the budget for next year and things of that kind. So they agreed that they would address the issue in mid-July. And they came, and it was a two-day meeting. And it required some careful planning. We had at least one alumnus, one member of the board, maybe two, who could not be there. But nevertheless, we arranged for their vote to come in one case by transatlantic telephone, so that the vote would be on the table. Lots of press attention, and we had set up a plan that once the decision was made, there would be a press conference. Since the result of the vote was in favor of coeducation, there was some discussion among the board about how to put our best face forward, and the phrase I want to use is to a man, but indeed I think there were at least one or two women on the board then. Again, I'd have to check to make sure. But to a person, once it had been decided, it was like where you go back and make the decision unanimous in retrospectively. And it was agreed that that one of the trustees who had made one of the more eloquent statements in favor of remaining all male agreed to appear as part of that press conference and spoke out in his and was represented to the press as having been an opponent and on the other side of the question, but he wanted to assure people that he spoke for those who had been on that side of the issue, that now the issue is decided, we will put it behind it, and we were all going to work to making Washington Lee succeed in this venture, and that there were no bad feelings among those who had not, whose viewpoint had not prevailed. And so I think we did a real good job, when I look back on that, of both informing the alumni constituency of the issues that were at stake, keeping them apprised of developments, and then in the follow-up, when we welcomed our first class of young women, and stayed with how they were doing, I think we did a pretty good job of saying to the alumni, things have not changed for the worse here; they've changed for the better. Your fears, which probably were legitimate fears of what might happen, have not come to pass. We're dealing with a much improved educational institution. Our students are happy. Let's address other questions.
Were the students happy? How did the males react?
Oh,
and how they met in July. When mm-hmm. did women arrive? Was there a year in?
Oh yeah, there was a whole year in between.
And so, what was the mood on campus in that?
Well, the mood on the campus was disgruntlement among students, rejoicing among the faculty. but the students they had done a number of things in the course of the study to make their positions well known. The most famous of which was draping old George with a sign that said "No Marthas." disgruntlement, and there were lots of low key resentment on parts of some students. T-shirts, you know, Coeducation of Washington Lee, the beginning of an era, ERROR. Various things like that. The women themselves, when I think about those 104 young women who came in here in that first class, I mean, your admiration has to go out to them, because they were coming into unknown territory. And but they were tough. One of my funnier remembrances of the first year of coeducation was the effort made by the Coeducation Steering Committee, of which I was a member. The Coeducation Steering Committee had been called into existence to plan the transition. So that committee's work actually filled up the year that intervened between July of 1984, 85. I lose track of the year, really, but it wasn't the following September, it was the September after that when we had the first women come. And we spent the year addressing issues that we would need to study and changes we would have to make, such as the physical modifications we made in the dormitories to take what had been men's restrooms and bathrooms and modify them for the women. And again, we thought we were very clever in this, and that we didn't rip out plumbing. We just simply boxed it in and recognized that we might have to shift around, might want to make that a men's restroom again, toilet. And so we did things like that. Over in the gym, we made some rather substantial modifications over there to provide the women with the physical education classes. They have to require to take physical education. We'll put in locker facilities and shower facilities. Again, trying to acquaint ourselves with the with the sensitivities of women. We were blessed by the fact that on our faculty and in staff and in our student in the law school, we had an unusual number of persons who had been present or even involved in co-education transitions at other colleges. And they were invaluable in being able to tell Washington Lee things we'd have to be aware of. And even so, we missed out a couple, but we picked up on it. One of the things that the Co-Education Steering Committee did in that intervening year, we sent teams to Davidson College and another team up to Franklin and Marshall College to pick their brains as to what they had done that they thought was good and what they would like to do over again if they could. And we came away with some very good new perspectives on things that we would have to do here. For instance, at Davidson, we discovered when we went down there something that just hadn't occurred to us here. It might have occurred to someone here, but it hadn't reached our attention, and that was this very severe problem among young women, that is eating disorders. We ran into at Davidson a very definite awareness there that you have to be very sensitive to this, that sometimes it's undetectable until it's gotten to a very serious stage in a young woman's life. And they had set up certain peer support groups there that were that worked from within. It wasn't anything that the administration itself did to identify young women suffering from anorexia and bulimia, usually your best sources of information would be their classmates who are concerned about them and might even be aware of some of the eating habits that they were pursuing. And so I think that this has helped us here in dealing with it through our counseling and peer support groups here. So these were good visits that we had, and we discovered another thing that I felt like was very worthwhile. We quickly became aware of how dark the campus was at night. And to the credit of our law students, usually most of whom come in with litigious chips on their shoulders, well, the women over there have been very tolerant of the fact that the main campus over here was pretty dark. We did a little better of lighting the law school, but if they ever came over here at night, it was pretty dark. So what we did, we got our master planning representatives from the landscape architecture firm in Pittsburgh to come down, and Mr. Arthur, the superintendent of buildings and grounds, joined us, and I got three volunteers from the law school, women's classes at the law school, to meet with us one dark November evening. Didn't have to be very late because it gets dark very early in November. And we had dinner together, and then we went out and we walked the campus. And wherever they told us that they felt unsafe or they felt that more light would help, well, we took note of that, and we then proceeded to light the campus in an acceptable manner. And there are still some areas that I think are a little dark, and we ought to do some more changes. You can't do it all overnight. And it's been some years now, 10 years, but in the main, I have tried to get Washington Lee to follow the way in which a man down at Davidson, their director of planning and buildings and grounds, he says if one woman comes to me and says they think we ought to have a light here, he says, I'll put a light there. He says, I don't fool around. So we found some clever ways to run conduit and things, and he says we try to put the light where they feel unsafe. And so in the main we've been, I think, successful in doing that.
You've alluded numerous times to these women at the law school.
Mm-hmm.
But you haven't told me about their arrival on campus.
Well, their arrival was compelled by different forces. There, the American Bar Association and the American Association of Law Schools, AALS, they do make a part of their accrediting process that you do not discriminate on the basis of sex. So we had to take the women there. We wouldn't have any choice on it.
Was there resistance?
No, no. I'm sure that there must have been, but I'm not familiar with how it manifested itself. I think it was just taken as a given. I believe the federal law exempts undergraduate institutions, but does not treat graduate schools with the same exemptions with regard to discrimination on the basis of sex or gender. So the law school really didn't have a choice. And as I said, we began to receiving our first women applicants and women students in the law school before we moved to the new building. And then later, as we got over there, then the percentage of applicants and the percentage of students enrolled saw pretty much its own level. And it runs about a third to 40% over there as well.
Now, another transition that happened while you've been here is the arrival of black students.
Mm-hmm.
Did that have an impact? I'm sure it had an impact socially. Did it have an impact academically?
Unfortunately, the numbers involved here have never been sufficient to make an impact.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, we would welcome as many young men and women, black students, Afro-Americans, that would qualify to get in here. But the difficulty is that we are competing with so many other colleges who are also seeking to have more black students. And so the competition among colleges for students capable of doing our work without special tracking for disadvantaged students, we do not succeed in that competition as often as we'd like to. So we're dealing with relatively small percentages of entering classes, small percentage of the student body who are minority students. And that applies not only to Afro-American students, it applies to Asians, it applies to Latin Americans. The great majority of our students are white, upper middle class, and that's just a fact that we've there are different views on whether this is good or bad. There are members of our board of trustees who think that we should seek vigorously greater diversity in our students, in our student body, and there are others who think, you know, that one of Washington Lee and indeed there are places in American higher education where you're not badly served by having a homogeneous student body. Now, I'm not able to quantify how many trustees have these differing views or not, but I do know that these differing views do exist within the current makeup of the board. Keep in mind, too, that the decision to accept black students at Washington Lee was made before we had these enlightened changes in the structure of the board. I remember during that self-study of the mid-60s that the self-study committee recommended that we accept black students, and beyond that, to recruit them with certain vigor. And I remember that since the report that we submitted to the Southern Association had to have the endorsement of the faculty and the Board of Trustees, we had to purge those remarks from our report that went in because the trustees were not willing to accept black students here at that time. And they didn't want us, I'll use the word, fouling up our self-study report by taking that point of view. So that was a real setback.
When did that change happen? And was it imposed by the government, or was it a change from within?
No, it happened shortly after the self-study. Within a year, I think we had our first black student here. It came from within. The government did not make us take black students. There were, again, I'm not enough of a lawyer to know exactly what the state of the law was at that time. There were certain conditions being attached to this, that, and the other in terms of you wanted to qualify for this kind of federal aid. You certainly could not discriminate on the basis of race. That was behind some of the thinking, I think, among board members who with a certain reluctance decided, well, we're going to have to do it. There were a number of members of the board who did not abandon the traditional white Southern attitude toward blacks. And Dr. Cole, when he was president of Washington Lee, he felt that we had to get into and remain in the mainstream of American education, higher education, and that the social changes that were coming about in the late 50s and early 60s, we had to be a part of that, that we could not exist apart from that. We could not deny ourselves access to foundation support when the foundations had become very socially conscious. And certainly the government was becoming more and more restrictive in how it was able to share its resources. And so President Cole felt it was essential that we do it. He was a Southerner. But his perception of the plight of the disadvantaged minorities was such that he was inclined to work very hard to do what he could to overcome that. And I don't remember as much about this as I should, but I recall he had good contacts within certain foundations, and he had good contacts within the Office of Education. And when Prince Edward County, I guess it is, down where Hampton, Sydney, and Farmville and Longwood College, that county in particular balked at integration and set up private schools for the white students of the county, leaving the public schools with only the black students and maybe white students you could count almost on one hand. And I know Dr. Cole worked with these friends of his to do things that would lift the quality of the educational experience at these public black schools, including Washington Lee professors going down to Prince Edward County and helping teach special courses and doing special things to stimulate the learning environment there. And he also worked with Hampton Institute to not exchange students, but programs that brought some of their students onto our campus and took our students down there. And for this he was often criticized. And he was not universally popular among certain members of our Board of Trustees. But what Fred Cole did was in my opinion, a very smart thing. He recognized early the qualities that Bob Huntley had in terms of his the brilliance of his mind, his reasoning powers, his powers of persuasion. He saw that he was a good lawyer. He made Bob, first of all, the university's legal counsel, and he also then, in order to bring Bob in contact in the best possible ways with members of the Board of Trustees, he made him the secretary of the Board of Trustees, so he'd be at all the meetings and would have these reasons for talking to the trustees. And Bob proved to be very persuasive in working with certain members of the board to lessen their stiffness on this matter of racial integration. And so he played a very key role in that transition.
Did the first black student come during Cole's time or during Huntley's time?
I think it came during Dr. Cole's time. I'd have to again check that.
It'd be it was, right on the edge there.
Two local boys. One of. You'd think I could remember their names. I know one of them was the son of Mrs. Smothers, who still works in the co-op. She's been working the co-op as long as I can remember Washington Lee. She and I joke about how long we've been here. She is retired, but she's also has come back to work in her retirement from time to time. And a lovely person, and her son was one of the first black students to come here. And the other was another local young man. And then we began to recruit, and again, heroic young men, in my opinion. When we were trying to decide how to communicate this change in admissions posture for Washington Lee, I was a lot more courageous in those days, and I proposed to Dr. Cole, and with Dean Gillum's support, that we lay our cards on the table. Let's say what we've decided. Let's tell the alumni what we think the consequences of this decision. We had this fear among some of our alumni that if we lowered the racial barrier, we would be flooded with black students, just like everyone thought we'd be flooded with women. We knew that was not going to be the case.
They flatter themselves.
Yeah, they do, and we knew that wasn't going to be the case. And so I did a piece for the alumni magazine in which I laid out, in the most objective manner I could, what had been done. I quoted Dean Gillum at length in terms of his perception of what we would do to recruit, how difficult it was going to be to recruit black students to come here, the words to the effect that when we did get applicants here that we could accept, likely they would be unusual persons. Because coming to General Lee's College would require a certain amount of steadfastness of purpose that would result in getting nothing but real good people. So I wrote the story. Dean Gillum thought it was fine. Dr. Cole thought it was fine, but he said. And this may go to explain a little bit of what we've talked about over recent weeks. He said, I think we ought to let the board know what's going to be in the magazine. So let's send it. I'm going to send it, circulate the story to the members of the board. This is not for their, to say yes or no to. This is just for their information. Well, unfortunately, three or four didn't want to be that candid. And even though the majority thought the story was fine, Dr. Cole decided, well, he couldn't run the risk of offending the rector of the board and two or three other members. And so, he asked me to change the story.
I'd like to continue.